Change Conference or Conference of the Parties or of the UNFCCC or COP28 is ready to get underway tomorrow, November 30th. The two-week CONFAB conference is hosted this year in Dubai, one of the Arab Gulf states' fossil fuel superpowers. That fact is not lost on critics, who already charge plans to allow oil companies into the meetings effectively makes the COPs less an environmental emergency meeting than oil dealers' bazaar. Dr. Joan Russo is former leader of the Green Party of Canada, who since stepping down from the Greens has spent her time keeping the United Nations' feet to the fire as a reporter and filmmaker, recording past climate change conferences. She's also producer of the film Cooperatives, Counterpoint to Capitalism, and has served as the editor and driving force behind Peace, Earth, and Justice News, a.k.a. PEJnews.com. Welcome back to the show, Joan.
Oh, thank you. Well, as far as I can see, what the main thing that they're trying to do this time is what is called stock taking. But they don't go back far enough. They just go back to Paris and see what they've done since Paris. But Paris was so flawed, and I could get into that later on. But I'd like to go much further back, and I'd just like to read something from a very important document that happened in 1988, and there was a climate change conference in Toronto. 300 global scientists, along with many other participants, concluded humanity is conducting an unintended, uncontrolled, globally pervasive experiment whose ultimate consequence could be second only to global nuclear war. The Earth's atmosphere is changed at an unprecedented rate by pollutants resulting from deposition of hazardous toxic and atomic waste and from wasteful fossil fuel use. These changes represent a major threat to international security and are already having harmful consequences over many parts of the globe. It is imperative to act now. Now, this is from 1988, and they called in the global community to reduce CO2 emissions by approximately 20% of 1988 levels by the year 2005 as an initial global goal. Clearly, the industrial nations have responsibility to lead the way both through their national policies and their bilateral multilateral assistance arrangement. Then I'd like to go back very quickly. I won't go through the whole thing. To 1992, I was there when they drafted and passed the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is a legally binding document. What has happened over the years is that document has been completely ignored. And my interest is really showing that what is important legally is to enforce that document. And I don't know recently if you know that there was a United Nations General Assembly request to the International Court of Justice to review what has been happening in the past few years. And it was a wonderful review, very critical. But a review from the ICJ is not legally binding. What is legally binding is what was passed in 1992, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And it's a powerful document, and the role of the ICJ is when something can be legally binding is when, particularly when all states have signed and ratified it. And that is the case. All the states in the world have ratified this convention. And the important thing is making sure that they live up to the convention, but they just ignore the convention all the time. So I just like to just read the objective of the convention. And the reason I'm mentioning all this, that I have a proposal that I made in 2010 at the COP16 to the then president of Ecuador, that what they should do is all the developing countries should get together and take the fossil fuel states to the International Court of Justice. I still think that should be done because I feel they're just getting nowhere.
We spoke 2 years ago, and the idea then in from the Paris confab in COP26 was some sort of mechanism of accountability that the member nations would get together. What they called it at the time, if I had a note on here, oh, compliance, right? The signatories. The whole idea was to twist the arms of the signatories into compliance with the 2015 Paris Agreement, that as inadequate as it is, as you describe, I mean, at least it's something. And yet here we are down the road, and the what compliance mechanisms there are aren't followed anyway. I mean, when you say that the 92 agreement is enforceable, what does enforcement look like? Have we moved the needle at all in any meaningful way, and are countries being held accountable, or what?
Well, I was very much involved with the one in 21. I was there, but I went through the documents that were prepared ahead, and it was very interesting. There were two documents, and there were two options, and they were the good options and the not so good options, probably proposed by the corporate sector. And in one of the goals was to make commitments, but that was not included in the bad document. What was included in the bad document was contributions, but when they're required to make commitments in the convention, contributions, it didn't make any sense at all. And those contributions were all over the place. You know, they didn't have a common base, and they didn't have a common percentage. You know, there was no way of evaluating them at all, and there were so many constraints in the 2015 document. And so what could make it, well, as I mentioned, the role of the ICJ is
the international
International Court of Justice,
right?
And its role is to interpret documents, and when they interpret it, they find out according to ordinary language usage, and so they for instance, the objective of the convention was to, let's see if I just get that. I did a little drawing, it helped me. Okay, the objective was, in accordance with the convention, stabilizing of greenhouse gases at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Such a level should be achieved within a framework of time so the ecosystem can be restored, and so that's the major object. Article 2 was the objective of the convention, and that is what they're supposed to do, but they're not doing that. They're just not doing it. They're evading it all the time, and it's getting worse and worse. Because I remember what was happening. One of the really seriously bad things that came out of COP21. Was the notion of net zero.
Oh, yeah.
And Canada loved that. And the tar sands were jumping up and down about it, because it means essentially business as usual with some dubious offset somewhere. And that's what's happening now. You probably heard recently, the latest thing that they're going to be spending money on is carbon capture And it's going to be on indigenous lands, of course. And the indigenous people are very concerned about it. They don't want it. They know that what's going to happen is it's going to perpetuate the tar sands. Because if they can, that's the whole, I remember looking up at the time, the first time I heard that, and that is what came out of the COP21. The first time I heard that, I looked up to see how the fossil fuel, how the tar sands were responding to it. Well, they were just in glee, because that meant that they could continue doing what they want, and then they would try to find some offset.
And carbon capture, maybe you could explain briefly. I mean, a lot of people have probably heard the term, but I mean, generally, how is it carried out? I mean,
I don't know all the details, but the concept is, well, we've got a problem with CO2 in the air. Well, no problem. We'll just put it underground. And this is, they've been trying to push this for a long time, but it is only going somewhere. In Canada, they're putting, what is it, $17 billion or something in it. And as I pointed out, the First Nations are against it, but they're just ignored as usual. This is what one of my big concerns, why at all the COPs that I've been at, is how the developing countries are ignored, and the First Nations are ignored. And this is why I think that there has to be some legal, there's a legal mechanism. Now, you're asking about how does it make it legal? Well, if the International Court of Justice interprets gives its official interpretation of the convention and says, if the developing states take them to the International Court of Justice. I know so many people have been going, and groups, I think the youth went to the International Court of Justice. But if as many, many, many developing countries could come together and take a case there, because it's, the first time they were really, really interfered with was in 2009 in Copenhagen. I can remember that I was with the media, and I went at 3 a.m. when Obama suddenly was there under the flag. He converted a whole room of the conference to a large room, and had the flag, the American flag up. And he said, "We have a deal." Well, I was standing there with reporters and with developing countries, and they said, "How could we have a deal?" And of course, it was done behind closed doors. And they said that it would be okay for the temperature to rise to 2 degrees. That was going to be in the document. And all the developing countries spoke out and said, "Fie, you know, we can't have 2 degrees." And there was already scientific evidence distributed that indicated that that would be the disaster. And you know that. Now they're talking about 1.5, and we're getting almost there now, or if we're not there already.
Well, I remember the 92 meetings, the inaugural, and the Canadian youngster at the time, Severn Suzuki, the famous David Suzuki's daughter, spoke in Rio and gave an impassioned speech. It was a big launching, and it was a big to-do. Now Severn is creeping into middle age. And I don't know that anything has been done, far from having mechanisms of accountability. And you mentioned the International Court of Justice. This year, the story coming up, and I alluded briefly to in the intro, is that the BBC is reporting, leaked documents reveal COP28 president and UAE national oil company boss Sultan Al Jaber's plan to discuss boosting fossil fuel business in bilateral meetings about the climate summit. This is talk about the money changers getting into the temple here.
Oh, exactly. I mean, this is just, when I heard it, I just couldn't believe it. to have him sitting there, I don't know if he's going to be chairing the meeting as well, but he's going to be having a lot of meetings, which he will be chairing. I mean,
well, he's president of the meetings, and they've asked him to step down from his duties as CEO of the National Oil Company. Well, they've asked him to, and he's refused. He's sitting with a foot on the dock and a foot on the boat, so to speak.
I know it's ridiculous. And, you know, when they're looking back at, again, pointing out a COP21, that it was really interesting. I can remember when I was reading through the documents, this was later on in the meeting, there was no reference whatsoever to fossil fuel. No reference at all to fossil fuel. So look how, and they're talking about what was that term? Note taking or whatever. What is
that? Stock taking.
Stock taking, yeah. Well, and so I started to read the stock trading, all the things that they were doing, and I don't know how they'll ever get to consensus, which is itself a problem at all the conferences. The consensus always leaves out the developing countries. And they're so concerned about getting for their reputation, getting a document that I've been so many UN meetings where there's such a push to agree for the NGOs not to criticize, it'll all be one happy family. And I think this time, and they have been complaining about the participation for years about the participation of the corporate sector. And
well,
they have.
Well, in the statement from COP28, they talk about global stock taking, and although the president, I'm sure, as you mentioned, is more concerned with stock trading.
Good point.
But they say that it says the global stock take completed by UN climate change this year showed us where progress has stalled, but it also highlighted the tools to get climate action moving much faster. They go on to say that nations must make some commitment to triple the amount of non-fossil fuel energy and double efficiency over the next 2 years. For some reason, the 2 years seems to be, I guess, when the next meetings are or what, I'm not sure. But that's what they're saying has to happen. Is there some significance that I'm not aware of with 2 years? Is that when the world comes to an end if we don't change or what?
Well, there's that time, I won't say it, that's more likely than getting them to change. You know, but they'll still continue. That's the problem with net zero, because and this started with Trudeau, I seem to remember, you know, with the Kinder Morgan, when he took over Kinder Morgan.
Yeah.
He was rationalizing that if we continue with Kinder Morgan, we'll get the money so we can put it into non-fossil fuel, socially equitable, environmentally sound energy and so forth. And so this really, net zero really, I seem to think it did come out of Canada. That was one of the big proposals. I mean, that's their way for, as I said, for business as usual with some offset, and that's what Canada's doing. And that's
they'll pay out of their massive profits for pollution, as if paying, you know, throwing money at it will make a difference. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joan Russo. Joan's a former head of the Green Party of Canada. Since then, she's been going to these United Nations confabs, these COPs, trying to keep their feet to the fire, and the United Nations generally. She's recorded films of past climate change conferences and produced the film Cooperatives, Counterpoint to Capitalism. And she has been for many years the editor and driving force behind Peace, Earth and Justice News. That's PEJnews.com. Well, Joan, again, looking at, you mentioned the developing nations and how they're ignored traditionally at these meetings. There is something in the welcome message about that, and it says developing nations who did least to cause this crisis have been starved of climate justice and resilience for too long. Last year's COP in Egypt delivered an historic loss and damage fund. This year's COP in the UAE must put meat on the bone of this fund. That means putting real money on the table. Table scraps won't cut it. So again, they're trying to throw money at the climate and making us believe that we can still chug along, be a and the money will help, you know, alleviate that problem.
Well, that's when I stopped looking at their nonsense, when I saw someone from the U.S. government said, U.S. will help those who have been harmed by climate change, but not, we won't be bound to do so. And I said, well, that's when I started to think about the legal thing and went into all the things that we could have done, should be done. So the problem is that the governments don't respect the International Court of Justice. And I was in the International Court of Justice when Yugoslavia took the NATO countries to the International Court. And all NATO countries stood in front of the court and said they refused to recognize the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. So I think that's the most that we've got to have. It should have been compulsory. There was a flaw in the charter because they didn't have to it wasn't compulsory for them to go to the International Court of Justice, but they do. They go to and get the legal opinions, but then those are non-binding. So what they need is for the International Court of Justice to go through carefully. You know, what I've remembered in the conference too is that they always say they were mindful of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, but they don't say what is in it. You know, they just keep saying we're mindful of it. But I mean, that's where the precautionary principle is in that. There's very strong, and they talk about principles and commitments. It's a very, very strong document. But in all the times I've been there, they always say how much they respect it, but they don't respect it.
Yeah. I'm looking at the Twitter feed from COP, just using COP28 as a search reference. And there's a posting up there from Extinction Rebellion Global that is addressing so-called green capitalism. And their quote is that green capitalism just means that there's, instead of wars for oil, there's going to be wars for lithium, the element used in electric cars and such. What about your book is about cooperatives and capitalism, cooperatives as a alternative to capitalism. Is this all just kabuki as long as capitalism remains the driving force, the organizing force for the humanity on the planet?
I mean, I gave a presentation at a cooperative meeting in our conference in Ottawa, and I said, can cooperativism exist in a sustainable cooperative system, be sustained within a culture of unsustainability? And it's really difficult because they're just overwhelmed. There is an ICA, an international cooperative group that has, I haven't been involved for some time. This was in 2008 when I went there with someone doing the film. But unfortunately, it hasn't been released. We've done it. It's there, but it hasn't been released. So that's from 2008. Now, that's not the way to promote cooperatives. But I think that is, we even when we went there, you know, I can't remember the organization. The OECD, which has in it cooperative, but it's not really a cooperative. I arranged an interview with the head of OECD about they made a big thing of it because we were doing the film at the time when there was the a collapse in the economic collapse. So they seemed more sympathetic at that time with I was looking at alternatives, so they invited us there to be give a presentation. So that, but I think cooperatives are the way to go, definitely.
Well, it reminds me of the Africans, the way things are set up right now, the old African aphorism that about the story about the babies being and the river and people downriver finding babies floating in the river, and they all mobilize to take the babies out of the river. But it's not until someone says, well, maybe I'll go upriver and see where these babies are coming from and stop these babies from being thrown into the river. When you're talking about cooperatives in the context of a capitalist world, it really seems like you're trying to gather the villagers to pull babies out of the river, and not, it doesn't address that, you know, somebody is throwing babies in the river.
Well, that's why the most important conference I went to was the one organized in Bolivia, because that was bringing together governments, socialist governments, and NGOs, and it was a really powerful conference. And that was all addressing the issue of capitalism, and that's what was considered to be the root cause. You know, as Chaucer said, the root cause of evil is avarice. Well, he'd probably be saying the worst evil is capitalism. But if you were around,
well, what's the difference? I mean, really?
Yeah, exactly. That, yeah.
Well, John, we're fast running out of time. I mentioned earlier that you know, in the context of what's happening in Gaza, earlier by that I mean in the previous segment, but in the context of news right now, and you've been the editor, as I mentioned, at PEJ for a long time, Gaza is really up and center and taking every other story is being knocked off of the front pages, including the climate, as Ukraine did before that. As a news curator, what's your take on the prioritizing again?
Oh, I did. I just want to reiterate the importance of urging the developing countries to go to the International Court of Justice. I just wanted to finish with that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. If only climate,
well,
news.
It's not. The thing is, you probably heard that even CTV won't even allow reporters to use the word Palestine. So, you know, it just, the world is going crazy, and people have been fired for mentioning it. And this has been such a long struggle.
Definitely the issue of the moment, and rightly so. But
well, there's also another connection, of course, because militarism is increasing. Right. And what can be worse for climate change than more weapons and more using of weapons? You know, this is one. I mean, I remember being at one climate change conference where we worked there's a peace caucus and an anti-war caucus, and we came up with a resolution saying the elephant in the room is not dealing with the contribution of militarism to greenhouse gas emissions, and this is still going on.
And, yeah, well, and
increasing,
and yeah, and accelerating,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Joan, thanks a lot for coming on. And could you reiterate, is PEJ still up and running? Peace, Earth, and Justice? Is it PEJnews.com still?
Well, I have it on my own site, but it's not functioning in the same way. I just put it up, and I there's an archive there.
Right. What site is that?
It's drjoanrusso.org.
Dr. Joan Russo.
drjoanrusso.org. Yeah, because I couldn't. The GoDaddy just closed it down.
Go.
First of all, GoDaddy had a message going out that there was dangerous material on it, and there was a big warning, and there's a warning in Google too. And so I managed to get that off. But then they said, it was just too large. I mean, you oh. know, you were part of it. And actually, yeah. I think your article almost brought it down. How many? it was read by.
Well, that was a long time ago. And ironically enough, during another big invasion of Gaza in 2005 and 6, when we ran into so much trouble. And that's a whole nother episode in itself. Well, John, we are out of time. So, but thanks a lot for coming on again, though, eh?
Well, thank you, Chris.
And I want to also
Always
thank,
good to talk to you.
well, absolutely. And I want to thank Dan Kovalik as well. And peace and prayers for Gaza.
Yeah.
That's all I got time for this week. Till the next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.